This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii's immigrant community is on edge with so many changes on the federal landscape. The need for lawyers to help with immigration cases is growing. HPR's Ku'ube Hiraishi joins us this morning to talk about how the University of Hawaii Law Clinic is stepping up.
That's right. Aloha, Catherine, and mahalo for having me. Yes, so what we're looking at right now is for folks who've been paying attention to the situation on the U.S.-Mexico border, that has overflowed and brought its found its way to Hawaii shores. So we have an estimated, it's a rough estimate, there's no real concrete number out there, but according to the folks over at the law clinic, as many as 40 families that were finding their way up through the Mexico border, found their way to the U.S. Once they got there, the services that were there, and I think we've seen a news coverage of the detention centers, family separations and whatnot, U.S. was really struggling on what to do with these, with this sort of all these families. And one solution was to ask them where, if they have any family here in the U.S. elsewhere, and if that was the case, send them there to live with their families as they seek asylum here in the U.S. So we have 40 families, according to one estimate, mostly on the Big Island. So they have family that was already here working in a coffee field or in agricultural field work type of jobs. And they are to stay there until they are able to get to the immigration court and make their case for asylum. So these individuals are being helped by the law clinic up at UH, so the Refugees and Immigration Law Clinic at UH Law School. Professor John Egan sort of breaks down what he's been seeing from working with some of these folks over in South Kona on the Big Island.
So what has happened is that we have been seeing people arriving here in Hawaii. They typically are people who have come through the southern border, and they're given a plane ticket and a notice to appear in court. Quite often, they're very economically challenged. They're not, you know, their pockets are not full, and they're operating in a language that's completely foreign.
Right. So little money, no command of English, and they're summoned to immigration court. It's hard to imagine that they can find private lawyers. So they aren't, as we might know under U.S. law, they aren't afforded public defenders. Pro bono lawyers, sometimes hard to come by already, stretched thin by other legal help needed in the community. But even with legal representation, it's really hard to navigate the asylum process. And it's been changing, becoming gotten harder under the Trump administration to be able to actually be granted asylum. So these individuals, I think one study that was mentioned in the interview, a 2018 report by Syracuse University found that 90% of asylum seekers without legal representation were denied asylum in 2017, 90%. And then half of those who did have lawyers were also denied. So it's not a guarantee that legal help will mean a win for these individuals. But Egan and some of his students over at the law clinic have taken on about a dozen pro bono cases so far. And he talks about how that process has worked out. And he estimates that there are more that will be coming and seeking help from him.
Immigration cases take a very long time. So we start a case and it may go on for a couple of years before we get to an outcome. We've got a couple of dozen cases working, but only right now I would say about six of those are active, which is to say we have six different families whose cases are scheduled for court hearings. More are coming. We screened two more cases just this past weekend. The students and I took a brief trip over to the Big Island and screened some cases there. So they continue to come.
That's right. So he is currently, the law clinic is trying to recruit volunteer lawyers. So lawyers, not necessarily immigration specific lawyers, but any lawyer who's willing and able to help out with the cases, if not to be there to represent these individuals, but just to help with research or, you know, doing any paperwork that's necessary. Because for the most part, it's a rough go. Yesterday, I had initially scheduled to meet with two of the immigrants that were coming in to show up at immigration court, because we only have one here in Hawaii, and it's here in Honolulu. So they had book tickets to show up in court. At the last minute, I believe Tuesday afternoon, the court's system was down. The computer system was down. So the hearing was rescheduled for October 30th. So just that initial, you know, having to pay for that flight, figure out transportation, things like that, knowing that they have very little money. And as we know, asylum seekers aren't allowed to work, work under U.S. law, so it's hard to gauge whether or not when they do get to the opportunity to get to court, if they'll have everything that they need to be successful in that endeavor.
And it's interesting, too. I was talking to some folks who work with the immigration community, and they were saying, it's not just immigrants coming from specific areas. Mm-hmm. You've got places in Central America, right? Honduras.
Right.
And there was also folks coming from like Ukraine, which I thought was really interesting.
Right. And you know, Hawaii's had a long history of immigrants coming in from around the world. And this specific issue with those in sort of the Northern Triangle, so Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, these individuals in particular, I guess they've had, and this is interesting, so some that were sent to live with their family that was living here is also undocumented, but had been living here undocumented for some time, trying to stay sort of on the down low and, you know, get through the process, seek asylum at some point and bring their family over. But now they've sort of been thrust into the limelight because now they have, they're migrant. This one particular family, a mother who was here undocumented, her son ended up going through the U.S. border. And when they, when the authorities asked him, who can we send you to live with? And, oh, my mom lives in here, and I'm going to go there. Mom undocumented, and so some hesitancy to participate in the process, even though her son is going through it itself. So it's a very complicated situation for some of these families who have undocumented status on both ends of the triangle.
So do we have a lot of immigration attorneys here in Hawaii, in the state?
So my understanding from speaking to those at the law clinic was that some of the it's not that there aren't immigration lawyers, it's that it's hard to fit into your schedule doing pro bono work for families when you've already got, like you were saying, a lot of other immigration cases going on here in Hawaii. We've got folks coming up through COFA countries. We've got folks from the Pacific, South Pacific. We know the Philippines always with a big, in terms of representation from immigrants. So it's a matter of figuring out if there are lawyers out there who are willing to take on extra work for free, which, as you know, for you and I even, would be something hard, a hard decision. But in speaking to Egan, I think one thing that really kind of stood out to me was that, for a long time watching the news coverage, I think a lot of Hawaii people didn't realize that we were seeing some of these families come to Hawaii. So here's Egan to speak about that.
This is happening all across the country, and we've been seeing it on the news, on the southern border and some of the larger cities across the country. But I really think that people were of the idea that maybe this wasn't happening here in Hawaii, but it really is. And so one way or another, we're going to deal with it.
Right. So looking for other lawyers to jump in. We've already gotten some phone calls so far since the piece aired. So hopefully more will jump in line here. But we will see a lot more of these individuals needing to come to make their court appearances here in Honolulu. And hopefully a lawyer will be by their side.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was HPR's Ku'uwei Hiraishi talking about the call for pro bono help with our growing number of immigration cases. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Maybe you start your day with coffee, or at the gym. No matter how or when your day begins, start it with Morning Edition from NPR News, a unique mix of national, global, and local stories, now available on demand weekdays from 7 to 3. Just say, "Alexa, play Morning Edition." Morning Edition, on your schedule from NPR.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We're tromping through the forest for today's backyard quiz, searching for a tree that is known for its beauty as well as utility. It's been said that the Waikiki home of Kamehameha I was surrounded by these trees, as were many temples in Tahiti. The seeds of the plant were brought to the Hawaiian Islands by early Polynesian settlers, as the tree was said to be spiritually connected to chant and prayer. But its qualities go beyond aesthetics and mysticism. The bark was once used for cordage fiber. It yielded dye and oils and served medicinal purposes as well. The wood from this tree was prized in the crafting of canoes, utensils, furnishings, and jewelry. So what is the name of this versatile plant, a tree that you may have in your very own backyard? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting the Afropop Okaija Afroso Trio from Ghana, performing Tuesday, October 22nd. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
More than 100 scientific studies may have to go back to the drawing board and double-check their research to account for a defective operating system. This summer, a University of Hawaii first-year researcher, a graduate student, stumbled across a computer glitch while trying to validate data on a cyanobacteria project. Turns out it was not a chemistry snafu, the code needed a fix. Scientists got different results depending on what computer they were using. Mac, OS, Linux, or Windows. In our studios this morning, graduate student Yu Heng Liu, who uncovered the glitch, he was joined by his advisor, Professor Ray Sun. They are computational chemists who work on models using computers as opposed to organic chemists who do physical experiments on the bench. Both work on the same problem, they just approach it differently. Organic chemist Philip Williams reached out for some help from his computer counterparts, Liu and Sun, but no one expected this discovery. We hear first from Professor Ray Sun.
I was very surprised because, for one, the nature of the calculation was not that complicated. So the idea is they have these chemicals being produced in the media of a cyanobacteria, and before they can get a full structure with experiments, this product degraded. So they have very limited evidence. They have some ideas of what this molecule should or would look like, but they don't know that for sure. So they turned this to our computation group, and we could do some calculations to kind of confirm or not confirm a certain type of structure. So regardless of what the molecule looked like, we would expect different computer behave the same way as the input is the same, because the outcome of the calculation should depend on the chemistry instead of computer. So when Yu Heng first told me this, I was a little bit puzzled, and I thought, okay, you know, you are a first year grad student, maybe you are doing something wrong here.
Hit so the wrong button.
Exactly. You know, we all make mistakes. So I asked him to double and triple check the calculation. After, I don't remember how long, we finally came to the conclusion. It's like, okay, maybe there's nothing wrong in the protocol of how we did this, but really there could be a problem with the computer program.
And so is it a particular program? Was it the Linux? Was it the Mac?
So this calculation is a multi-step process. The way this works is it's not a, in the most common sense, the program that we use on a day-to-day basis. It's really called a bunch of scripts. Basically, a script does a certain number of things. On a more like fundamental level, if you are a computer science major, the idea is you can run that script and it should spit out a certain output that will be used as input for the next step.
Right, so it was the coding.
Yeah. So the whole process is about 10, 15 steps. It's one of those steps we realized there is a problem there.
Okay, so then you knew you were right, that there was something not lining up, right?
Yeah. So we start to suspect if the results depends on different operating systems. And we also test this script with a few more computer Linux, and they also give us the new different result. So I go to look up the code to test the code line by line. Then we finally find the problems is caused by when the code with the output file, the means with the data, they read the data in a incorrect order. So we just add one line of code, just sort the file, then we got the same result as wrong.
So you fixed it. You found the fix.
Yeah. And and Dr. Sands add many lines of code to check if we make the mess up the data file. So if we lost one of the data files, they will show the errors. So this code now will avoid some human errors. Then I think it's good to use for a couple of years at least.
Okay, and so tell us though the implication of this. So you discovered this glitch, you found a fix, and now there's research though that has come into question. They have to go back and take a closer look at their computations, correct?
Correct. So, you know, as the corresponding author of this paper, Dr. Williams, said, this protocol of using computational chemistry to help identify structures from NMR experiment, so that protocol was published 4 or 5 years ago, and it was cited 158 or 160 times in the last 4 or 5 years. So there are a few moving parts here. First is just citing that paper does not necessarily mean they actually use their protocol. They could just cite that as a general acknowledgement, you know, when they're talking about this kind of experiments. And the second is remember we talk about the validity of the code depends on what operating system you are using. And usually that's something people don't report in their publication. And I think for a good reason, because usually people don't expect the result to be operating system dependent. So, and another thing is when they published the code, so we were in contact with the original author of this code, and they told us the code operating just fine for whatever test they have done. And I have to give a lot of credit to to the first authors. You know, they are very in support of publishing our result and make the code better. So it is really hard to tell how many publications might have been affected. We can just speak for our own research.
Here at the University of Hawaii.
Correct. So what Yuheng has told you is he cannot reproduce what another grad student, Rom, has found. The level of inconsistency is noticeable. That's apparently how we found this, but it didn't change the whole story of this finding per se. So even though technically speaking, the result is flawed. So we don't really know how much this has compromised other people's research. We just couldn't comment on that.
Right, but obviously those researchers here at the university, they'll probably go back and take a look just to see.
That is our hope. You know, as we said in the paper, if you have used this code, maybe you know you could find your old input file and just run through. It's a 5-10 minutes job.
So it would be a quick fix for them.
Correct.
But you want the research to be sound.
Yes.
So that's why it's important that if there was this flaw, that it get fixed and we correct that going forward.
For sure. And again, to the credit of the authors of the original paper, so I think they are in the process of publishing a correction to their original paper. So people who have used that will have access to that, and they could check their calculations.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you must feel pretty proud, though, knowing that you helped to correct something, because, you know, there could be so much lost time.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that's just lucky for me to find the error.
And I'm sure the department, you know, is beaming, though, is proud to know that these young minds are looking and they're analyzing, and they can come across or detect, you know, some errors.
Yeah. I think I have to give a lot of credit to my grad student Yuheng here. You know, he didn't just like kind of crumble and like, oh, you know, is it me or is it the code? Usually, you know, when you are first year graduate student, you're not so confident about you versus someone else's work. So I give him a lot of credit. Just bring this up and kind of power this through, and he insists that there's nothing wrong with his procedure. It's really the code. And yes, the department is pretty excited. And to be honest with you, this is a little bit surprising to us as well. You know, we just want to do our research. And if we, so first of all, we need to make sure our research is sound. And then if we found something that could affect science in a more general case, you know, we want to publish it. But I was talking with Dr. Williams yesterday, and none of us actually expected this kind of publicity. So,
yeah, but it's a good pat on the back.
It is.
Because so much time goes into scientific research, and if you're led astray because of some coding issue, that could set you back.
For sure.
What did your family say when you told them that you were able to detect this error?
Yeah, they said I just want to do something to find out some errors, and that's it. They are proud of me. Yeah.
As Dr. Williams has pointed out in this paper, sometimes, especially, so I think the nature of this problem is kind of a cross area. So the original authors are organic chemists, when they publish some computational product, I feel this field have this nature of just take that as granted, use it and assume whatever computer spit out the number is legit. But if you are just talking the language that experimentalists use, if they got a chemical, let's say from a different group, they would run many rounds of verification to make sure that chemical is really legit and mm-hmm. purified and so on and so forth. Interestingly, they tend not to do that for computer programs. So this is just a kind of a good reminder for everyone that, you know, if you get whatever the kind of secondary product from a different research group, it's good practice to make sure that it works as it's supposed to be.
So maybe this could set a new protocol?
For sure. So this is just, that is certainly our hope. But the nature of this program is very subtle. It's usually you would not expect to, because you know we all have our desktop we use either for personal use or work. Usually you wouldn't just moving your data around to do one set of calculation here and another set of calculation there, and if you just use one set of computer, that will give you consistent result. But depending on the operating system, it could be right or it could be wrong. So what we really hope is you should, as a researcher, adapt a code. They really should run some testing cases that are provided by the authors, which they did in their original paper, and just to make sure this setting is working as it should be locally as well.
Right. Double-checking protocol. That was University of Hawaii professor Ray Sun and first-year graduate student Yu-Hing Liu, who is credited for finding the computer glitch. Their paper was just published in the journal Organic Letters last week. Our reality check today takes a closer look at the pushback on wind and solar projects across the state. Honolulu Civil Beats business reporter Stuart Yurton joins us this morning. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, yeah, we're in the throes of this pushback over there in the Kahuku side on Oahu.
Yeah, so that's right. We have a pushback against a project, AES Corporation, a big energy company, is trying to put more windmills in Kahuku. The neighbors, residents there are pushing back. It's the sort of protest that we've seen in some other projects recently. We decided to take a look at what it means for the broader push on Oahu, where we're about to have a whole bunch of renewable energy projects that are going to be unveiled.
Right. Hawaiian Electric just put out that RFP, so we're waiting to see what comes through the pipeline.
That's right. So they're, and again, this is huge. They say it's the biggest RFP in the company's history. They're looking to replace the AES coal burning power plant at Campbell Industrial Park. And the power plant produces about a fifth of the electricity for Oahu. So it's an enormous source of electricity for us. And so you can imagine you're taking this one entity that burns coal and produces all this energy and splitting it up into a bunch of renewable projects that are going to be spread out all over the island, the thought is, or at least in a lot more places than this one power plant at Campbell. So the question is, are people going to accept that?
Right, and there are a number of green energy projects. They've got the Palihua Ridge, just a number of places across the state.
That's right. There are a number of projects. There are a few that are also being challenged and being protested. There's the Hohunua. It's a project on the Big Island burning eucalyptus to generate electricity. It's a sort of biomass project. But again, we really wanted to look at Oahu, where we have this big RFP, and HECO's saying that we're looking at something like 29 times the size of Aloha Stadium in terms of the footprint of all of these projects. So the question, again, is in this time when we're seeing really active citizen engagement and civil disobedience to stop projects, is this going to be doable in the 2 years that it really needs to be done before the coal plant is supposed to go offline?
Right. So I can see where they're probably saying, well, gosh, you know, can we see the forest, you know, for the trees? Are we just getting stuck in the weeds when the bigger picture is, you know, we need to think big and go green?
That is a question, and it's a fair one. And I don't think from talking, you know, we talked to a number of environmental lawyers and others who advocate for green energy. I don't think anybody's really saying we're going to lose sight of the big picture. But there are certain laws that need to be followed, regulations. There's the idea of due process for citizens being able to participate in certain procedures that are part of developing something. And that really can't be shortcut, because what we see is so often, you know, people try to take a shortcut and it ends up being challenged in court. And often the developer was wrong.
And, you know, because we've seen the Kapu Aloha movement there on the Big Island kind of spread, we saw what was happening with Waimanalo with that city project there, and now with this Kahuku windmill project. I mean, it's another layer of risk that these green companies have to consider.
It is a layer of risk. The one thing, though, is the PUC, Public Utilities Commission, that regulates these, they're optimistic that they have built into the RFPs procedures really to get community engagement, and hopefully they can be proactive. The developers of the projects can really be proactive and avoid any of these things. So the PUC is very optimistic. They say they have cause for optimism, and we're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, I know Hawaiian Electric has said that, you know, just generally there seems to be more acceptance with solar farms than wind turbines.
Well, yeah, that's one of the thoughts, that solar farms have a lot less visual impact. As we know, you drive across under the North Shore, you see these windmills. It is pretty striking. So the hope is that solar farms will be a lot more acceptable to people. But again, we've seen some of those challenged. So we're just going to have to wait and see.
And, you know, I know that it's something that I think both sides are looking at closely because, you know, businesses want to, you know, they've got a timeline, they've got a bottom line, and, you know, this whole issue of protests, you know, versus rules, that's something we're going to have to watch closely.
That's right. And again, this is an important thing. We'll see how it unfolds. And I know the utility, HECO, is really interested in trying to get these projects online.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. Head to civilbeat.org to read his story and more.
I am one of those millennials that likes to set it and forget it. I have 1,001 things to do, so if I can create a way that HPR is supported through my donations without me having to continually check on it or remember to pledge, I think it puts a different value on what I'm doing with my money. Hi, I'm Nicole Reed, and I am a very proud sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
Boys get the message at a young age: don't show your feelings, don't rely on anyone else. How do these messages affect them when they grow up?
One of the fixtures in the apartment was a post that runs floor to ceiling, and the post became my friend. I would hug the post. I would hug the post for all it was worth.
Rethinking what it means to be a man on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 7, following Says You.
We are still getting listener feedback from our call-in show on electric vehicles. The carbon footprint of electric vehicles spurred Lynn from Ocean View to call our talkback line.
I've been blessed to have a 2003 Toyota Prius, and it's half electric, half gas, and it charges itself. So I'm reducing the carbon footprint at least by half, and I guess I don't have enough knowledge about totally electric cars, but can't those cars go to something like that? A generator on the wheels that recharges the batteries that help the car to run on electric? Thank you so much. We all need to reduce our carbon footprint. Aloha.
We also received an email from Robin from East Sound, Washington, on another issue. Currently listening to the conversation, she writes, which was October 8th, the Republicans who deem the impeachment inquiry as a waste of time show a flagrant disrespect for our Constitution and for our democracy. They should be ashamed. Thank you. And mahalo for sharing your feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter or call our talkback line at 792-8217.
Without a doubt, Says You is the toughest quiz show on the air and one of the funniest forms of recreational thinking. How did the princess release the frog prince from his spell?
As I recall, the original version of it ended with the words, "Tastes like chicken."
Spirited and civil, brainy and boisterous, Says You.
Tonight at 6:30, following Marketplace.
Earlier in the show, we asked you to name and describe a tree that holds an important place here in Hawaiian culture. While there are many trees in Hawaii that are revered for their versatility, Milo is the answer to today's quiz. There are those who say that the beautifully grained Milo wood, utensils, furnishings, and jewelry were only for the chiefs of ancient Hawaii. Although rare today, in old Hawaii, Milo was a commonly found tree cultivated as a shade plant around homes near sunny coastal areas with loose soil. Milo trees can grow up to 40 feet, and the trunk can be 2 feet in diameter at full maturity. The bark is corrugated with scaly twigs, and the branches are widely spread and full of heart-shaped leaves, making for an ideal shade tree. Bell-shaped pale yellow flowers with maroon or purple centers are also part of the Milo tree, which happens to be a member of the hibiscus family. In addition to outward aesthetic, the wood from the Milo is also exquisite and used to craft canoe and poi bowls. If you haven't hugged a tree yet, now you know what it looks like. Find a Milo and give it some love. Thanks to our resident tree hugger for today's quiz. And our winner for the backyard quiz is Wayne Gao from Honolulu. He used to have a Milo tree in his St. Louis Heights home up to 8 feet high. And that's today's quiz. If you've got an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. In our Forest and Garden segment, we throw the light on the upcoming woodworking show. There is a new venue this time. The exhibit will be at the Moanalua Gardens in the Chinese Cultural Hale. The show will open this Saturday and run for a week. We talked to Peter Simmons, who is with the Hawaii Forest Industry Association, about what's in store and also about the challenges of protecting our native forests.
Hawaii Forest Industry Association believes that healthy forests and healthy communities go hand in hand, and that part of healthy forests has to do with crafts and arts and woodworking, as well as conservation stewardship and so on. So, yes. But this is always, that's always been our theme. It's always been, education has always been a category for us, and so that we want to attend to. Because so many people don't, although they're surrounded by wood, they don't really pay much attention to where did it come from and how was it harvested and so forth, and we want to bring that to the general public so that everybody can have a better or deeper understanding. Some years we highlight the watershed performance of the of our forests and how they help us percolate water into the into our aquifers, and other years it could be about aggressive exotic plants. You never know what we'll come up with for the theme.
And there seems to be some problem with theft.
Yes, unfortunately, agricultural and forestry theft is a fact of life in Hawaii right now. trying to do something about it, working with the state legislature and the government to try to figure out ways that we can decrease that theft, whether it's through chain of custody or how we're exactly going to do it, I can't say. But, yes, it's a serious problem, and it affects everybody because if somebody is stealing wood, and typically they're stealing it from the tree itself, they don't take the time to reforest or treat the land properly. And so it's not only the theft itself, but it's also what's left after the theft that's a problem.
Right, they're just taking.
Exactly.
They're not giving back.
No respect for the forest or the community.
Well, share with our listeners, you know, how bad it's been or what you've seen from what you've heard from the community.
Well, I live on Hawaii Island, so I'm more familiar with, you know, incidents here. But there are roads that run through private land, like our Mana Road, and that runs through state and private land. And it's easy to pull up next to a tree at night and cut it down, take a branch or whatever, hack it up. And people are pretty cautious. I think the general woodworking community want to know, okay, where'd you get it? But that's not true, and people do lie about where they got their wood, so that's part of the issue.
Where else is theft a problem? What other islands?
Kauai is the second island that I've heard is being affected the most.
And what types of trees are we talking about? Koa?
Generally, it's koa. But it could be milo, low elevations, and, you know, kamani. Anything that has, once it has a high value, it becomes target.
What's the cost of koa these days? What's it up to?
Whew. Well, not to get technical on you, but there's all different grades and qualities and so forth. But I can tell you that in 1967, when Kamehameha Schools announced that it wanted to reforest some lands with koa, they were kind of ridiculed in the local paper there in Honolulu for thinking that it had enough value to pay for itself. And today, that's, of course, way, 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 way not the case. There are many thousands of acres that have been rededicated to conservation stewardship and growing koa. But it's a continuing struggle to bring it all the way to market.
And there is a lot of effort, as you mentioned, going into reforestation. You know, there's talk about, you know, carbon offsets and lots of research into figuring out, you know, the whole carbon formula. And so, yeah, it's a problem if there are, you know, major efforts going into planting new trees and there are people, on the other hand, that are just stealing their trees.
Well, part of the wood show really emanated or evolved from knowing that the koa supply was going to be diminished in the coming years. That was like before the first show. And the question was, how can we use what we have better to bridge a period where we might not have the abundance of koa that we had? And so that was really part of the germ of the wood show and showing that forestry and harvesting and so forth can be done properly and can be a benefit to the community. And I think that's continued, that the effort of restoration forestry and just repurposing land from pastoral use to, say, koa growing or natural systems uses, it's really taken a huge leap forward. If you think that, like, the National Park has purchased Kahuku Ranch in Kau, Kamehameha Schools has got several reforestation projects with koa. The state withdrew some lands from pastoral use up in Upper Mauna Kea. And it had mostly Mamani, but a bunch of koa, too. So there's been and is an ongoing serious effort. And it's not, you know, it didn't start yesterday. It started probably in the, I'm thinking, 76, 77. But the first attempts that I'm aware of for reforestation with koa, it was that were done in Honaunau Forest by Kamehameha Schools in 1931.
Wow. And look at it now.
Yeah, well, it's evolving. People are learning, working at it. Some people have learned to use the younger koa some thinnings to make beautiful guitars and other things. So, you know, we're all kind of learning this together.
So talk about how, for the first time, you folks have asked that woodworkers not include ohia.
Well, I believe this is the first year. I could be wrong, but, you know, basically, there's an injunction against shipping ohia island to island. And, of course, nobody wants to spread the rapid ohia death around. And so it better to be cautious and careful and not take that risk while we're trying to improve the condition of our forests. We don't want to be wrecking them at the same time. So that's kind of the inspiration for that.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some beautiful ohia wood floors and furniture. But, yeah, sadly, we want to protect what we've got.
Yeah, and at this stage of the disease, we really are struggling, I think, in terms of what to do with all the dead trees. The Forest Service did do an experiment to see at what temperature would the fungus be killed and logs could be shipped. So there is a way to ship logs. I believe it was the temperature in the interior of the log had to be raised to 135 degrees to kill all the fungus and have that as a certified technique. And the idea is that once that's done, you know you're not shipping the fungus around. So people are aware of the idea that people want to have ohia, and there's an abundance of it, but at the same time, you got to be very careful. So that's kind of the state we're in right now.
Now, last year's show, you did have some kind of showstoppers. I think you had a dress out of koa. Anything like that for this show that you can share?
No, I think you're going to have to go down and look, because last year that dress was pretty shocking and pretty amazing and awfully beautiful.
It was.
The history of Hawaiian woodworking, going back to the Hawaiians, the Hawaiian people were just awesome, awesome woodworkers, sculptors and woodworkers in general. And so when the Western culture arrived, the Hawaiians already had a very sophisticated taste for their woods. And the ship's carpenters that influenced, and the missionaries and everybody that came here were just astounded at the quality of the Hawaiian woodworking. And a lot of the influence in, for instance, bowl turning came from England. They had caught on in England, and the Hawaiian culture grasped onto the techniques and took it even further, you know, made it even better. A fellow named Henry Weeks over in Kona was a master woodworker in the 1880s, and his work is still revered today as it was then. You know, when Hawaii is looking for advantages economically, one of the things we have is this history of high, high, high quality, and I'm just talking about our woodworking, but our artisans in general are just awesome, and they've continued to challenge each other through the show and improve their techniques and improve their artistry and design, and I believe that on a per capita basis, Hawaii has some of the very, very, very best and the most abundant, really high-quality woodworking going on in the United States.
Oh, I think when we first saw the carving, I think is it Ron Kent with the Norfolk?
Yeah.
That was kind of an eye-opener.
Yes, yes. And, of course, there's two Ron Kent awards this year. There are awards for various categories. Ron passed away, unfortunately, but he left a legacy, both of his intellectual legacy as well as an award for innovation.
We've been talking with Hawaii Forestry Industry Association's Peter Simmons, talking about the annual woodworking exhibit, which will be held at a new venue this weekend at Wanlua Gardens here on Oahu. Well, Well, that winds it up for today. Up tomorrow, we talk Big Island Trash as it grapples with the challenges of recycling. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. And hey, you know, if you missed any of this show or if you want to find a past one, find them all on the conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of the conversation.